Colin Flynn is a fourth-generation tillage farmer from County Kildare. 7 years ago, he realised something was wrong. As he says, I knew my land was in trouble when the crows stopped following the plough. So he decided to move away from intensive, chemical-based methods towards farming for ecology as well as production. He has worked hard to create a farm that is productive, profitable and full of wildlife.
I was traditionally a almost 100% tillage farm. It was all plough, tilled, power hard as per was tradition, and had noticed quite a deterioration in the quality of the soil. And I've said this before, but one of the kind of moments for me was when I realized that crows weren't following the plough anymore. And I began to question what was going on, and I had a deep sense of that there was something serious happening. The ground was getting harder to till, to get a seed bed, and yields were being compromised. And I decided I would have to make some form of change. And it was fortuitous that the Danu project came along at that time, and I spoke to Dave Wallace and Danu, and he explained to me initially what the project was going, or the EAP program was going to be, the research was going to be about. And I said, listen, Dave, the room I'm in, and scraped in at the end. As I called myself the Judas. I was the last lad in. Well, someone had to be last anyway.
Sure, that's it. And tell me, go
ahead.
Oh, yeah. What's your own journey on this farm? I mean, have you been farming there since year dot, or?
Yeah. I was born and reared on the farm. Like everyone at younger my age, we were kept home from school at times to farm quite a lot. And I know I've mentioned before about this, but I thought, having got what they call the junior cert at the time, that I could have got into Gertie and Agricultural College on the strength of my junior cert. And the next thing, my father broke the bad news, and he says, no way. He says, you're not going to Gertie in a junior cert. He says, you have to sit your leaving cert. And he used a phrase, and it still sticks in my mind. He said, he'd been dealing with tick farmers all his life, and he said, you're not going to be one of them. Right now, you know, but I didn't. I thought I was leaving school, but I did a leaving, went to Gortine, yeah, and then entered some more, obviously more pro, or what you call more layers of education. And after that, either through green certs or whatever, you know, or the 101 courses or whatever, you know what I mean. But I've always had a deep interest in learning anyway. So like, it wasn't, I didn't have to be engaged in a program to learn something from it. It was kind of like one of those guys that follow Manchester United. They don't have to be taught. They learn it themselves. Mm-hmm. And I just loved learning farming as well. I didn't have to be taught. I just soaked it up. But I also had a very, very deep love of nature from the time I was a child. Like myself and my little Jack Russell, we're always gone up the bog or something, you know what I mean? If it's a Saturday afternoon, skiving off somewhere, chasing rabbits or doing something, you know what I mean? Mm. So from a very early age, I had a deep understanding of nature. And, and as I say, at that time when I noticed the crows not following the plough, you know what I mean? That deep sense of nature had, you know, clicked the button like that and said, listen, there's something going on here. Mm. You know what I mean? Now, there was an interesting, it was another occasion, and it was when I was involved in golf course work. And a greenkeeper had used Draza slug pellets to kill casting worms on a golf green. And I said to myself, wow, I've been using Draza slug pellets to kill slugs. It didn't say on the label I was killing the worms.
Mm.
And different, I haven't used, yeah. You know what I mean? So like those moments, you know, they really enforced there was something wrong. You know what I mean?
What were the first changes that you started to make after your kind of your pivot moments? Do you know this?
Well, the first one I did, even before I kind of signed up for the Danu program, was I decided I would introduce grass onto the farm. Now, some of our land hadn't been in grass for over 100 years, right? It was continuous tillage. It happened to coincide with the return of the dairy when the quotas were lifted and the return of the growth in the dairy industry. And I have a little kind of motto myself, follow the money. You know what I mean? If the money was in dairy, and I didn't want to start milking cows myself, but I said I would get as close as possible to the money line as I could. So I put in grass and I entered an agreement with a local dairy farmer that was expanding. And that was the start of it. And I had ground in grass when the Danu project started, but I knew I had built a relationship with this farmer, and that if the Danu project was going to involve grass and my idea was to rehabilitate the soil, I was going to kind of marry the whole lot together. It was a rehabilitation of the soil. I was going to use the Danu project to see was there any mechanisms that could be put into that to facilitate the rehabilitation of the soil and use the grass as the medium. Mm-hmm. Now, that's where I started out 4.5 years ago in the Danu project. It has grown exponentially since, you know what I mean? It's been a fantastic project. Started out with small trials on the farm, and sure, it was only a matter of a couple of years, like, and what I was learning was being rolled out on, you know, a lot more of the farm.
So just so we understand, so you started turning to grassland. What crops did you have? What did you change to? So what does your farm look season by season these days?
Well, I still have all the horse crops that I've always had, but I've introduced one extra. There was wheat, barley, winter wheats, mostly winter cropping. It was a farm that suited winter cropping. So I would have had winter wheat, winter oats, winter barley, and then a spring crop of peas for bachelors. And I was tricking around with oilseed rape once or twice there as well. And I tricked around with beans for human, or not for human, for animal feed as well. And that model had worked. That model was a very, very, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, that was a very, very successful model. Like, it, no one gave a hoot about mm-hmm. the environment at the time. It was, you know, it was put on more. You were making very, very good money, but you were spending a lot of money on chemistry, pesticides, fertilizers, but you didn't give a hoot. No one did, because the message at the time from the EU and from everyone else was more, 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 more. Produce mm. more, produce mm. more, produce more. And it was coming from that background of the surge in the demand for food and the needed beef. They had beef in intervention stocks, and they had grain mountains, and they had lake mountains, tobacco mountains, they had mountains of everything. And they were subsidizing it. Like, at that time, it was an 18-day strategic supply of food within the EU had to be maintained at all time. Now it's down to under 3 days. Mm-hmm. So, like, we had a strategic supply of food at that time. Now it's 3 days. We saw the fallacy of that last year when the Ukrainian crisis started. Within a very, very short time, we were seriously choked up. You know, the supply chain was choked. The price of fertilizer had gone through the roof. The price of grain was chasing up after the price of fertilizer. Food was going to start getting more expensive again. You know, people have seen this massive rise in food costs, the inflationary pressures and all that associated with all of that.
So what's the biggest changes to your farming system
what I've learned is I can still produce viable returns by reducing the level of pesticides and fertilizer that are being applied to the ground. I've also realized that even though we still have some ground under the plough, that each year more and more ground is being taken away from the plough and is being cycled into this kind of model of rehabilitation that we're learning. You know, I mean, I didn't go all in at the start. I'm not that kind of gambler. But as we build, because we're building this on our own, like, these are farmers building this on their own. This is not state sponsored research or anything like that. Well, it's what the Danu project is. It's through an EIP, but I mean, it's not, we're not getting the support from the mainstream research department. So like, this is farmer empowered and farmer driven research. So like, obviously we have to build our own confidence around all that.
Sure. And it's kind of different farms have different systems and different kind of needs and stuff like that. And do you find, like, with your systems of pulling back pesticides and stuff, what did you actually do? Sorry, did you start doing cover crops, green manures? What was your actual way of changing your system?
Yeah, well, obviously cover crops were part of it, and developed and learned more and more, and still are learning. Still learning, we are all learning, you know, I mean, the role that cover crops, the nature, the type of seed, when you sow it, the cultivars that you use within the mix, they're all part of the learning course. And we don't mind, we're learning as we go along. But the key thing is the acceptance that the way forward is to maintain living roots in the soil at all time where possible. Mm-hmm. And once you strive, if you set that as your kind of your overhead banner, you know, and then it changes the way you look at stuff. So you're looking at stuff with regard to trying to keep living roots in the soil as much as possible. And that in turn then is building the soil biology. But in tandem with that, there's the science, right? When we looked at our soils and did a deep soil analysis on the minerals, we discovered that we have an abundance of P and Ks and trace elements and things like that in the soil. But because we've basically killed the soil with pesticides and fertilizer now, we don't have a living soil. So we can't access that. It's there, but we can't get at it. And we have to develop the biology is the key. You know, it's the key to get in there. And once you have the living roots and you can support the biology in the soil, whether it's either through bacteria or fungal or whatever activity in the soil, you're accessing that reserve in the soil and replacing imported fertilizers, right? Now, the other thing that's coming in tandem with that is the return of all little trace elements, the coppers and the manganese and the zincs and all those, you're also accessing them, which is giving you a healthier plant. Mm-hmm. Your healthier plant can fight off disease. It's not as soft, as green soft, as nitrogen-driven foliage. And there are observations we're learning around there. There's observations we have with regard to like the control of aphids and things like that. We don't use pesticides anymore. We now realise that a good, healthy plant with proper nutrition, as in the plant that gets the Barocca boost, right, that has the correct mineral makeup, right, is able to fight a lot of this stuff off itself. Mm. And to that end, you know, we send sap analysis over to Nova Crop in Holland. It comes back based on that. We try to analyze what we're getting, and we make judgments ourselves.
Do you soil analyze each field, or do you just take one from?
We did some serious. Dave Wallace had out sneaking holes. I'm telling you this much. I shook hands with Australians. I did actually, but not through the hole. Yeah, but you know, I mean, we did some serious research. We you know, we were doing water infiltration tests. We were doing soil compaction tests. We were doing biological assays. We were looking at the bugs in the ground, how many we had. We're looking to see how we fungal hyphae in the soil. We're looking at a whole gamut of stuff, like really interesting, like for us, you know what I mean? But
and do you recommend that any farmer should that could be a starting point for them, or is that just kind of specific to the Danube project?
Okay, you cut your claw to measure. Yeah. If you're like me, you love all that crap, right? Someone else couldn't be bothered with that. That's an individual choice, right? And you can wing it. I think when you become aware of it, and you become aware of the fascination, and you become aware of of the greater biology around the farm, whether it's, you know, the role that the cover crops, etc., and the mixed species swards and the grass and all that play with the bumblebees and the honeybees and the butterflies and all the other stuff. And you see all that sort of stuff coming along as well. And, you know, equally, like we've got involved in the EIPs with regard to the pollinator program, and because it dovetailed into what we were doing so simply. And the two of them are actually, the two EIPs are actually feeding off one another. And I think there's, you know, it's a case of one and one making three, you know, or making one and one making four. It's a kind of, it's a larger thing. And there are an awful lot of farmers engaging in this and feeding off one another. And the level, as you said, the level of understanding is really up to the individual. You don't have to go down the whole route, but if you adopt the basic principles, it's going to happen by default, really. You know what I mean? It's going to happen for you, as long as you don't kind of go. But like, the opposing side of that is, right, you have all these other external forces coming at us as well. You know, I mean, we're going to have to learn how to sequester carbon. We are going to have to learn how to supply food. We're going to have, you know, food security is a major issue. You know, so if you're going to look at these, you will soon realise that it is through this concept of a living soil, a living biology in the soil, that you actually sequester the carbon into the ground where it's safe. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's what I would call stable carbon. You know, I've bogland behind me here. We have forestry behind us here as well. And one thing that struck me last year is when the bog went on fire, right? And I said to myself, that carbon isn't that secure. You know, one match and it was gone. It's gone back into the atmosphere. All across Europe last year, we witnessed hundreds of thousands of hectares of forestry going up in smoke. That's the carbon gone back into the atmosphere. How secure was the forestry? We don't know. It's a lovely idea, but how secure is it? Whereas when we can sequester the carbon into the soil through biology, it is safe, unless we don't plow it back up again or disturb it too much. You know what I mean? It's safe there, right? And that in turn keeps that soil in production to maintain the contract that I as a farmer have with you as the consumer, which is that unwritten contract for tens of thousands of years, is that we as the farmer will produce the food for you. And we, if we can maintain the soil and rehabilitate the soil, we are reinforcing that contract that we have, I have with you, that I will supply the consumer with food. And that contract is never written, but it's understood.
Yeah. So just going back to your system a bit more, are you still on the grassland a bit? Do you still have grazing dairy cattle on your farm?
Okay. Yeah, and took out the first, I've released the first block of ground that I took into rehabilitation last spring. It went into, and it wasn't ploughed. It was in a grass sod and it was sprayed off with a very, very low rate of spray, about quarter the normal recommended rate, right? Yeah. And it was direct drilled into that grass sod. It was taken to harvest. It was harvested. The straw of that was returned to it. Again, it wasn't disturbed. It is now in a crop of winter wheat and still hasn't been disturbed. Mm-hmm. And the most amazing thing from me as a nature head is out there at the moment, I estimated today about 500 field fares and red wings on that field. And they have been there on that field for the last 6 to 8 weeks. And the strange thing about it is, like, when you think about field fares and you think about red wings and that, you said to yourself, well, they're going to be in the hedges peeling all the berries off the bushes up in, you know, and they are. But their choice is to come back to the field that has been rested and undisturbed. And they will spend most of the day there, running up and down the field, chasing after one or digging and looking for worms and all that, right? Having a great time. But then they will go to the hedge they will feed up on the berries and come back to it.
Yeah, nice diversity.
That, you know, it's the diversity, and that is, that's the first thing that's telling me that what the journey I'm on is right.
Mm-hmm. So where else on that, where else have you seen kind of nature responding to what you've done? Is there any other kind of...
Yeah, well, as I said to you, we are monitoring the bumblebees and the honeybees and the solitary bees and the mining bees and all those, right? That's grand, that's one. We're also looking at the soil biology, the assay of the soil itself, where we will send it to a lab and they will come back after putting a microscope on and tell us exactly how the various little critters in the soil are doing. Right, we're hoping to see a rise in that. They'll also tell us the new different types of fungi that are now thriving in the soil because we haven't broke up the fungal hyphae, and that, so that's going to, that element is going to build. So we'll get figures from the lab with regard to that. We are also, you know, worm counts were another one we did. We will get the worm counts back, whether the deep digging worms, shallow worms, mid-range worms, all those will come back. More scientific data, right? So we're putting a lot of science into this as well. Now, on top of that, we were required by Dave Wallace to do a kind of a baseline data. So I would have recorded all the birds through here over the course of a year. I went on a field walk, then several field walks, I didn't do it all in one day, where I recorded all the different plants that I could find. And because I was tick ignorant about it, I actually got my sister and my other sister, who know the botany a lot better, and to come along with me and maybe go on their own and tell me, well, do you know, Colin, you've orchids down there in the back field? Have mm-hmm. I? Yeah, go on down to the fence and have a look. They're in there down at the ash tree. Have a look in there, there's orchids. She said, never had orchids before. Well, you have now. You know, I don't have to do it. I can get other people to do it on my behalf, but because people like yourself and that love walking and looking at nature, and mm-hmm. I'd invite anyone to come here, and if they can tell me I have something that I didn't know, I'll take it forward, you know.
And because I also know that you kind of let your hedgerows off and stuff like that. Do you find that impacts or supports your farm in any way?
This is a lovely topic, an absolutely lovely topic. We've let the hedges up to provide more feeding, right? And for the first time now under the new programme, we are now going to be allowed to put biodiversity back inside the farm. And we're going to be supporting doing it. That was the big, big stumbling block up to now, was that we were not being paid, we were being penalised to have environmental zones and things like that within our farm. Now we're actively being encouraged to do it. And I think that's a fantastic idea. Mm-hmm. I think the safest place to have the yellowhammers and the sparrows that are on the side of the road and everything else, particularly the yellowhammers in this particular place, because they're species that are under threat, and Kildare has a fantastic population of yellowhammers still, right? Predominantly because it's a grain tillage area, right? But when we can get them back in onto the land, back in where they're safe, at the moment, because we have been penalised for trying to do that kind of thing, they have been on the road margins. They've been in the road hedges. And as you know, Kildare is a commuter town, or commuter area. And we have witnessed, every one of us have witnessed killing someone on the road, whether it's a cat or a dog or a bird or something like that. Every one of us had. If you haven't done it, you haven't driven, right? And it breaks my heart to do that, but also breaks my heart to see the yellowhammer sitting on top of the pole and then realise 3 weeks later he's not sitting there anymore, right? And what we've effectively done over the last number of years is we have, because of the fact that we've been restricted in having the access on the farms, we've been dependent on the road margins as corridors for wildlife. But we're putting them on the side of the roads. Mm. So the minute that we can get the environments back inside, in safely, back inside on the farms and not be penalised for doing that, I can see fantastic benefits for the wildlife. And I'd even go so far as to say, and I've talked about this a good bit now, I would say that when we have sufficient environment or environment established inside the farms, that to protect the birds and to protect the wildlife on the road, that we actively seek out mechanisms to deter the yellowhammers for selecting the nest site on the side of the road. But only if we have sufficient space for them inside. And that may well warrant a revision of the hedge cutting. You might say, well, actually, what you might need to do is in the month of March is trim the side of the road when the yellowhammers start deciding where they're going to go and nest. Mm. And so, as she says, or he says, whichever was doing all the courting, right? They're talking, we're not up in the bush, yeah, right? They're saying, right, I have a grand spot down here.
Yeah, sure. They're smart enough. I'd say they know where the good stuff is, like if they can.
yeah. But, you know, it's just an idea. I mean, it needs fleshing out. But but up to now, it hasn't been possible because we've been penalised. But I think if we get the safe corridors in on the farms, that I think we can actively look at this and say, listen, lads, we don't need to be killing this stuff on the road. Mm. I think we need to develop and give it a certain amount of thought and say, right, what are the things we can do to discourage roadkill? You know what I mean? Yeah. Because it's another one, it's another interesting factor, because I looked at for all the information I could find on roadkill. I asked the minister even, right? I thought the National Roads Authority have something. There is diddly squat. There's a full data set, a massive data set. That's not in existence. And yet the farmers are being blamed for the loss of wildlife. And yet no one has gone to the trouble of monitoring how much of it is being taken out by commuter traffic.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's a butterfly, a bumblebee, or a yellowhammer, or a badger, or a deer.
Yeah.
They don't have that. They don't have that data set. And that, to me, is laziness on someone's behalf, that data set, which is huge, it's a huge data set, is missing.
Paul, I'm just going back to the economics of it a bit. I mean, you've mentioned before that you have decreased you have stopped using pesticides. You've decreased a lot of your inputs. Has this meant that your outputs have changed or your overall yield has changed? And is
You see, when I was a young lad, it was all about yield. Jeez, you'd be down in the pub and you'd be telling lads you're getting tons of that. I said the best yields I ever got were over the counter in Moulia. But it's now down to economics, right? Mm-hmm. It's not the yield, it's your margin.
Mm-hmm.
It's your margin over cost. And with the skyrocketing cost of fertilizer, right? That bonus yield is not as lucrative as it used to be. And that's all right in a good year. But when you get drought years, you get caught. Now you have to, I can tell you, 2018 was a drought year.
Mm-hmm.
2019 wasn't. 2020 was. 2021 wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
22 was. There's three droughts in 5 years. It's only two good years. That's three risks you have taken.
Mm-hmm.
Now, can anyone risk at the present cost of fertilizer and inputs? And it's based on, and the return in the harvest just gone out is based on an elevated price for the grain driven by the conflict in Europe, because Ukraine and Russia were both massive wheat exporters.
Mm-hmm.
If that can be resolved, and I hope to Jesus it is resolved, and the wheat starts to come back out of Russia and Ukraine onto the European market, right? What you have then, you have a very, very expensive crop going in because you've bought all these expensive inputs. And next thing, the price of grain is going to fall.
Mm-hmm.
Marry that with a drought and you're hiding to nothing. You lose your shirt.
And on the drought thing, so just to clarify, your yield has come down, but your margins have kind of stabilised is what you're saying.
Yeah, well, that's what you're. Yeah.
But the biological element
will deal with the drought aspect of it eventually, because mm-hmm. now you're giving your ground far greater water retention capacity, because now you're building the humus into the soil, you're building the biology into the soil, you're having all this soil particle formation in the soil, and that in turn with a greater diversity within the nature of the plants that you're sowing, you know, multi-cropping or whatever, or green covers in the autumn time, right? You are building resilience into the soil to withstand drought.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So again, this process is feeding in a lot of different ways. So you have to build resilience into, and biological farming will effectively mitigate against drought. I'm not going to say it's going to do away with it, because I believe that the climate is going to stay warming for the next 50 to 60 years, at least, before we can turn it around. So I don't know. I think at the moment, it will maintain Irish farming. I can't speak for lower European countries, but I certainly think it'll build resilience into our soil and give us greater capacity to withstand global warming going forward. I honestly do believe that.
And do you see in your own soils, like when you have periods of heavy rains, are you kind of seeing a difference than maybe 5 years ago in any way?
Yeah. Well, again, we don't have runoff, right? We don't have pooling on the farm. We don't have water gathering in hollows.
It did.
After heavy rain, we would have had areas of ground that would have had surface water on. You could see it, right? And it's a combination of roots, earthworms, soil particle, breaking up those layers of compaction that had been built into the soil over time from heavy machinery and actually just mucking soil at the wrong condition simply to get crop in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can destroy soil structure very, very simply. It's far easier to destroy soil structure than it ever is to build it.
Mm-hmm.
And this move towards a non-inversion or minimum till or no-till seeding is helping us to maintain soil structure. And soil structure is key to water infiltration. Now the cover crops in turn, right, they protect the soil from the hammering from the rain for a start. You know, that pump, pump, the bang, the, you know, it the living roots in the soil keep the soil open. The nutrients that are in the soil are being picked up by the plants as they grow over the winter time. They're not leaching into the groundwater. The green material that of above ground is harvesting all this sun's energy through photosynthesis. So you're harvesting all that free energy over the winter time into a store. Mm-hmm. So it's a store of both solar energy and the freely available and moving nutrients in the soil that would contaminate groundwater. So like, and it filters it. Even if the water did want to move, the fact that there's a kind of a structure of plants there, even if the water wanted to move on the surface, right, it's been filtered out. So your soil particles, this thing that you would have seen traditionally in a river, that as soon as it flooded, it turned brown. Well, that meant that someone's field was ending up below in New Ross eventually, right? It's not going to New Ross anymore. You can see floods in the rivers, but you notice that the water is clean.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not losing our soils. We're not losing our national asset. Our national, Ireland's national asset is its soils.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not sending that out into the Atlantic.
I mean, you're a commercial tillage farmer and, you know, you lease land and stuff. But do you feel that the having nature on your land, it enhances your product to your buyer or anything? Or is that you're stuck with middlemen that you're not quite, I suppose you're not going straight to a consumer. So, but do you think having nature on your land actually enhances your product or your premium?
Not at the moment.
Not at the moment.
Where the reward came, didn't put an ounce of money in my pocket. It was during COVID when people took to walking the roads and they'd stop and they'd look at a field with a cover crop in it or a multi-species sward and they'd talk and the next thing you could see and hear stuff. So the perception in the public's eye is changing. And in some ways, it's not necessary to concentrate on what the middleman does. If we can operate in that contract that I said to you between me, the producer, and you, the consumer, as long as you know that I'm doing my best to give you something that's nutrient dense and of a high quality, it doesn't matter about the middleman, because you will choose then to choose Irish product over strawberries bought up from South Africa or something like that, so that you can have strawberries on your whatever Christmas day. You know what I mean? I don't know, but the message needs to be got to the public, right? And to that event, you know what I mean, the beauty about Farming for Nature and the beauty about all these other initiatives that are there and fantastic initiatives is our opportunity now to use social media, to use whatever media we can, to get the message out there that we're not trying to sell you something. Come and talk to us. Mm-hmm. We'll show you. You're free to walk my farm, right? Come out. And the people, I haven't told the people who walk in the road, so if you want to walk out there, walk out there. I don't mind. If you want to cross the fields, cross the fields. If you're invited by me, you're covered by insurance. But if you're not, you're a trespasser. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So when I ask in, you're a guest of mine, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And they say, well, maybe another day, but it's great to see it, you know what I mean? But it's part of that public awareness, you know what I mean? It has to be a good news story, because we know that when we crack this nut eventually, that we've already recognized that nutrient dense food is not the preserve of organic farm. It is part of it, right? Now, if the Department of Health, and I doubt this, but I'll be brave, if the Department of Health and the Department of Finance can understand that the biggest budget in this country as health can somehow or other be influenced positively by nutrient-dense food and new forms of farming. Well, that's a win for the state. It's a win for the finance, but it's a win for Ireland, Inc., the people. Mm-hmm. It's the people, right? And if we can ultimately use our green image abroad and use our island nation fact that we can control, even as a 42 county Ireland, we can control what comes into the country. And we can market this product internationally that as both organic and nutrient dense. Because the one fear I have is that the organic industry is small enough, and if we sail a massive ship of commercial farmers selling nutrient-dense food and who have gone through biological farming and so on and so forth, right? If we sail that ship into that harbour, we swamp the organic growers because we're too big and they're too small, mm-hmm. right? But what we need to do is create a structure where as a nation, we move this thing forward collectively and mm-hmm. both parties win. But we have to do it at national level. Now, that's a long way off. That's very aspirational, and that's a dream of mine, but I may never see it. But it's a way to do it. And it's mm-hmm. the way, your question was, how do I put a penny in my pocket? If we put money in our pockets at the national level, either through the health process, healthier people, better quality of life, and more money in our pockets because we're producing a better product in a more biologically sound way without depending on imported pesticides and imported fertilizers, right? That's mm-hmm. a win. If we're able to do that without that dependence on pesticides, we're now ring-fencing our biosecurity, our food security. So we're now able to produce more food ourselves. Mm-hmm. We can address the carbon issue, because now we're putting the carbon into the soil. We're putting it in a place where it's safe. We're addressing the issue of wildlife, right, which is a big concern with the public. right? And they can take down their binoculars and telescopes and photographs and come down and photograph till the cows come home. I don't mind. Mm-hmm. If you find something new, tell me. I'll be delighted. You know what I mean? I was corrected 2 weeks ago. I thought I knew what a sparrowhawk was, right? Only to be told by someone from Birdwatch Ireland. I wasn't looking at a sparrowhawk at all. I was looking at a merlin.
Yeah.
Right. I said, oh, so it's not a sparrowhawk. Okay, all right. Well, it was a merlin. Ah, yeah, they're common enough. Yeah. It was lovely to see. I said, thanks very much. That was the bonus that I got from that person walking the field.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, Colm, if you were to kind of meet an intensive tillage farmer and, you know, they had a spark of interest in what you're doing, but where would you, what's your kind of top three or four tips to them as to where they start? Where do they start making changes on their land? What would be your kind of message?
My message is, I would start by talking to your fellow farmers that have already engaged in this, right? Have a chat with them initially. Then do a little bit of soul searching yourself, right? And be honest with yourself with regard to your returns, how your level of exposure during the drought years. You know, it might do a couple of spreadsheets and talk to your accountant and a few things like that. And look at your level of exposure, level of risk. And then have, as I say, continue that conversation on. And then just reach out to people that may or may not know more. You know, I mean, I can think of, as I said, there are people in various agriculture colleges and universities in Ireland doing more work on this than some of our national research organisations. But there are plenty of people out there, mm-hmm. right? Don't be afraid to ask. Absolutely, do not be afraid to ask. I think if you go to the trouble of asking, you've already started the process. You're already on the move, because you wouldn't ask it if you weren't in doubt about what you're doing.
And where did you get your advice and support?
Notwithstanding the realization that I was on a hiding to nothing if I said doing what I was doing, it was fortuitous that the Danu project and the EIP programs had come along at the time. As I said before, Sean McLaughlin and the Knotts program had been fantastic. I think hats off to the boys, and they have brought a vast load of expertise from around the world to these shores, to us as farmers, either through the biofarm programs or through training programs, or encouraging the leading brands in the world to take trips to Ireland and organise field trips and conferences and so on and so forth. At the moment, we have some of the best brands in the world coming to Ireland to carry on. Gabe Brown, you have Joelle Williams, you have John Kemp, you had Dr. Christine Jones. I could stay going on and on and on about these people that are world leaders that are coming to Ireland and are delighted to come to Ireland, because we are now leaders in this with regard to, comparative to what's going on in Europe. I think we're up there with the best of them at the moment with regard to biological farming, mm-hmm. and what we are learning and how we're adopting practices that would work in America or Australia or New Zealand and tailoring to an Irish situation. And that has been recognised by the speakers that have come here, the experts from around the world. They really do love coming here because we appreciate it and we bleed them dry of information, you know.
So for anyone that doesn't know, BioFarm is generally the first week of November in, you can watch it online or attend it in person, and it's biofarm.ie. And the Danu project, you might just tell us a bit about the Danu project. It's not open for any new farmers if people wanted to know, but is it wrapping up soon? It's an EIP,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it is. The Danu project was started, it's a 5-year project. The EIP program was funded. It was decided at the start that when we looked at the budget and the managers looked at the budget, that the farmers themselves were not going to be paid a penny of it. right? So we haven't, the 12 farmers in it don't get paid. It is all as much as possible put into research and development of ideas. And if anything, initially it was costing us money, but what we've got fantastic knowledge. And geez, you couldn't buy it. You couldn't buy the level of knowledge we bought or received. And I think the
Resources or anything up online that people can find out this knowledge or share it, or is it?
Well, that is something that we're working on. We're working now because we are 12 farmers with a support team. We're working now on how we are going to roll out this information on the end. What mechanism? Your question earlier on, the farmer who wants to go on this journey. You know, and then we who have been on this journey, how do we get the information? So, yes, there's how do we make that connection, right?
You're in the process of figuring it out.
We're in the process of figuring it out, but we want to do it in a way that builds momentum. Mm-hmm. And, you know, initially you'd say to yourself, well, the easiest thing to do is to take the low-hanging fruit and collaborate with organisations like BASE and that. Which would be if we can get a good working relationship with BASE going forward as to how we disseminate this information, I think we could build a momentum. And yeah, I'd like to see that. I'd like to see that experimented with and see is that a mechanism. Because otherwise, if we try to kind of, we run risk of splitting ourselves so thin that we're ineffective. We just can't. You can't do it in the detail that needs to be done. So you need to kind of start with a wedge. You need to get the detail into the point and build it. There's no point going in like a dozer blade and trying to push something. It's just, it would be spread so thin it wouldn't work.
This interview was part of our online Ask the Farmer Q&A series throughout the winter. If you want to meet these farmers and ask them your questions on actions for nature on their farms, please join us for our summer walk series. More details to come on farmingfornature.ie. Meanwhile, if you'd like this podcast, please rate and review. It helps us spread the word.